Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man, Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face Off on WGN Radio. That's right. You're locked onto the high energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. And they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini of McDermott, Will and Emery, and Rich Lenkoff from Downey and Lenkoff. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. We've been following the aftermath of the Oxford High School shooting since 2021. Now, both parents of admitted shooter Ethan Crumley, James and Jennifer Crumley, have been convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to 10 to 15 years behind bars. We bring in Professor Jeffrey Schwartz of Cooley Law School in Michigan to fill us in. Professor Schwartz, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me again.
So, Professor, how did the judge come up with that amount for the parents? You're a former judge. How do you think the judge went into that analysis?
The maximum sentence for that particular charge is 15 years, but you had it's indeterminate sentencing there. So you have to set a minimum, which was 10 years in this case. So 10 to 15 was so. There, Michigan discourages stacked sentences, in other words, consecutive sentences, and there are only specific charges under which that can happen. Manslaughter doesn't fit into the statute, so 10 to 15 was the maximum that she could give as a concurrent sentence for all four counts.
So, Professor, Judge Cheryl Matthews cited several aggravating factors in announcing the sentence, including the parents' glorification of weapons, James Crumley threatening the prosecutor from jail, and Jennifer Crumley acting apathetic in a school meeting the morning of the shooting. How much impact do you think these facts had on the sentencing?
I think that she had to write something to aggravate up to the maximum sentence, and I accept that. I think that from the very beginning, it was kind of a given that if they were convicted, they would get the maximum sentence allowable by law. There's a very strong political issue here for the prosecutor, remembering that I have some differences with Judge Matthews on a number of her rulings involving the admission of certain evidence. I think that it's going to take the Michigan Supreme Court to reverse it, but I think it's going to happen. I think that at this point, Judge Matthews, having worked for or with the prosecutor, Ms. McDonald, I think all of it added up to this was just like a foregone conclusion, and she just needed to justify it some way.
So to explain that more, what reversible error do you think exists that would merit the Michigan Supreme Court overturning this sentence or this decision?
I think that she abused her discretion in a number of ways by admitting evidence under that should have fallen under Rule 403. That is, that the probative value was far outweighed by the prejudicial value. She allowed cumulative evidence. It was not necessary since the death of the four kids was clearly admitted to, and that's what happened and that Ethan committed it. They spent their entire case putting on evidence that was meant to anger the jury. Then they would put on technical evidence. Then they would put on more prejudicial evidence. And they kept the jury angry throughout the entirety of the case. And the closing argument of Ms. McDonald made it very clear that she wanted to operate on the jury's anger. So it kind of feeds into the idea that there were a lot of things that came in that should never have come in that were really under 403 and even under 404. I think that a lot of that evidence was introduced solely for its prejudicial value. It was also character assassination to a certain extent. And so as a result of which, I think that there's a lot of stuff there that should never have come in.
So many see this conviction as precedent setting in terms of holding parents accountable for their children's shooting. How do you think this sentencing underlies that?
Well, this sentencing sends a message, at least to people in Michigan, that if cases like this happen, whether it's mass shootings or whether it is just a shooting or whether it's just an injury caused by a gun by your teenage child, okay, that you are going to be held responsible for it if you don't fulfill certain obligations. Now, the obligation to conceal and or secure your weapon is now statutory in the state of Michigan, so it becomes easier to prove because the duty is established by the statute. And of course, a duty to do those things is part of the charge. That's also another thing that I have a problem with putting a duty onto the Crumbleys beyond what Mr. Crumbley did to try to conceal the weapon. He did not secure it. That's clear. But there was no duty to actually secure your weapon at the time these offenses took place. So they tried to use a negligence theory. And I'm not sure that that really is applicable here, but they got the jury to buy it. And I guess that's all that really matters.
Professor, I was fortunate enough to teach a law school class earlier this year. And yesterday I was talking to some of the students on Zoom. And of course, we discussed this case and some of the takeaways from it. I'm sure you discussed this a lot this year with your students. And by the way, we congratulate you. You're retiring a very distinguished career, both on the bench and as a professor. So we really commend you for that. But what are some takeaways that you and your students had from this trial, and especially, you know, with regards to defendants testifying? We know, for example, that Jennifer Crumbley saying that she would do nothing differently. She tried to change that yesterday, but we knew that was very impactful on the jury. What else did you and your students talk about with regards to this trial?
I thought, as far as Jennifer Crumbley was concerned, I thought that up until that answer, she had done herself a lot of good. Now we know that she was telling the truth, that it wasn't her job to conceal and or secure the weapon. That was her husband's job, because he admitted to that in his statement yesterday, that he had thought he had done everything necessary to conceal the weapon. So to a certain extent, the separate trials that they asked for may have actually hurt her, because she didn't have him sitting there or at least denying that he was responsible for that. So she kind of got hurt. But I thought she did a fine job. The problem was she showed no emotion to a great degree. And someone who's on trial, who feels that they may be somewhat responsible, maybe not completely responsible, is going to cry and is going to be show some emotion during her testimony. And she was a little too cold and a little too calculated in her testimony. He had no choice. He could not testify. There was no way that James could take the stand. And so in this particular case, like in other cases I've seen, I have never really seen a defendant talk their way out of trouble. I find that for the most part, even with lawyers that I've seen testify, just bury themselves somehow. And I think that her saying she would do nothing different kind of rang bad. If she had said, knowing what I know now, would I have done things differently? Yes, but I didn't know those things before, would have been the perfect answer. And she just couldn't get it out.
So, Professor, last question here on Legal Face-Off. So both the victims and the parents said that they want accountability from the school. Yes. What do you think will happen on that front?
I'm not sure that the school will do anything. They don't want to admit any liability, even to the extent that they didn't let these two people go. We're talking about the counselor and the vice principal, whatever it was, who made the decision to send Ethan back to class. Even though they now claim they didn't think he was a threat, but he was enough of a threat that they wanted the parents to take him out of school. That just doesn't make sense. One of them is still working for the district. The other one is not working for the district, but for a different district in the same role. I think that the Oakland County Schools just don't want to be financially responsible or admit any liability. But I think these two people clearly should have been charged. They had the ability and the duty to protect all the students in that school, and they did not do so. And they could have. All they had to do was send him to a rubber room for the rest of the day. That's all they had to do. But they sent him back to class instead. And if they thought he was dangerous, that was just reckless.
Reminder that the parents of both the suspected Highland Park shooter and the Waffle House shooter also faced charges related to the mass shooting. So starting to build here, we're seeing this more and more frequently. Professor Schwartz, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate everything that you've mentioned here.
It was my pleasure. Retirement or not, I'm always available.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers.
In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Next on Legal Faceoff on WGN, squatters' rights are very much in the news. In fact, I was just watching Republican nominee for president, ex-President Trump, discussing the latest alleged squatter issues around the country today. We've got a very special guest, Republican Senator Keith Perry, representing Gainesville. He's been in the Florida Senate for 8 years, completing his term, joins us today on Legal Faceoff. Senator, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, glad to be here.
So you have sponsored legislation, Senate Bill 888 in Florida, dealing with this issue. Tell us a little more about it.
Sure. So, I mean, you know, we've been hearing the stories about it. My wife was watching a newscast one night and when it becomes personal, when you really hear someone's personal story about this, and she told me, she said, man, you gotta do something about this. And, a lot of the bills that we file and get done come from different special interest groups or whatever. There was nobody coming to us. So it was just, myself and my staff taking this on. We found a House member in Steele that had, was looking at the same kind of issue. So, pretty appropriate timing. This was almost a year ago when we first started looking into this, and it was an issue, but it wasn't near the issue and didn't have near the focus that it has today. So we are very fortunate to get ahead of the game, meet with the governor's staff and work with them all during this process. And knowing that, hey, this is a huge problem for the individual. It's going to be a bigger problem for a lot more people if we don't get ahead of it.
So we know, we actually just covered the story in our last episode. We know the issue, right? The issue is that in many jurisdictions, it becomes very difficult to remove squatters from properties once they take hold. And in some areas like New York, it's as easy as, after 30 days of occupying a residence, acquiring rights to that. And it often takes months, if not years, to remove them legally. So what would your legislation do to remedy this problem?
Yeah. And back to just the original why people are taking the loopholes in the tenant landlord laws. And I really got to tell you that I've talked to a lot of groups, and we got some real conservative and real progressive groups over there. The more rules, the way that they think they're intended to protect tenants. I own a couple of commercial properties. I only own one duplex, and that's one too many dealing with tenants. If you deal with people, so they're looked to protect the most marginalized group of people, when in fact, if you are a landlord and you can have someone down on their luck, hard luck story, you really want to take a chance on them. You're not going to, because you cannot get them out according to the tenant. Now, what we did is we had people who were illegally in occupying someone's property. They were squatting on. They were taking advantage of these landlord tenant laws, which I think need cleaning up by themselves, but this does not address those. This says, And we want to put in guardrails for the tenants. So what we simply said is, you as the owner or an agent of the owner, fill out an affidavit. That's under penalty of perjury, a felony, that you said, look, this is my property and these people have no right to be there. They're not former tenants. They're not late on a payment. They're not anything like that. They're not my immediate family members, but they're illegal. They have no right to be there. You fill that out. You take it to the sheriff. He verifies the information, who you are. They go to the property and remove that tenant immediately. They can charge them with trespass. Also, if there's damage to the property, they can charge them with a felony if it's over $1,000 worth of damage to the property. So, and now those people who've been removed, they can use the civil courts to go through and say, no, I was wrongly removed, and that's fine. And we put in all these other safeguards, treble damages, get attorney's fees collected. So we wanted to protect people who should maybe, late on a payment or something. That's not who we're going after. These people are 100% illegally on your property, occupying it. I half jokingly and half not said on the floor of the Senate that we need to call this the relocation bill, which is we're relocating you from someone's property to jail, which is where they should go.
And to your earlier point, Senator, you know, people, I think, on the other side of this issue sometimes perceive the landlords as these, you know, large corporations. And in many cases, there are. We all know about, you know, the trend in large corporations, sometimes foreign corporations taking over property. But, you know, the perception is that a lot of people on the management side of this issue are these, you know, incredibly wealthy landlords. In reality, much like yourself owning property, a lot of times those who are trying to evict illegal squatters are small business owners. This is their only source of income, and it's just a business for them. And having these people occupy their homes without any income is incredibly devastating to their business and their way of life, correct?
Well, not only are they losing potential income, which they're still paying property taxes and insurance and bank notes and all the other stuff. The one lady in Jacksonville that I've met on several occasions, Ms. Peoples, who testified in front of committees, they not only occupied her house for about 6 weeks, she spent $5,000 in legal fees to get them out. They did over $40,000 of damage to this lady who had sold her little consulting company, bought two homes, renovated them to make income, kind of her retirement. You know, you're talking about $50,000, $60,000 in loss to this lady. That's a big hit for, you know, that's not a big giant core. It's not fair anyway. It doesn't matter who you are. These people are stealing and damaging your property. But you're right. The people who hurt the most are the people who are trying to maybe have a little extra income or retirement. And then they get hit with this stuff. So again, these are criminals taking advantage of a law, and they should be charged with trespass. They should go straight to jail. If unless there's other circumstances, and certainly they're damaging your property, but there's no reason to have the civil courts decide that, you know, your property was stolen and you're going through the civil courts. No, your property is stolen. Someone took your car, stole your car. You should get it back immediately, and they should go to jail. You shouldn't have to go to the courts, get your car back, get anything that's yours and get it back if you can prove rightfully that it's your property.
That's Senator Keith Perry, Republican, representing Gainesville in the Florida Senate. Thank you so much for updating us on this very important issue. And please come back to Legal Face-Off in the future.
Anytime. Thank you.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. Well, there's a triple murder case going on in Washington state. And in that case, the defense team wants to enter in AI-enhanced video as evidence. But a judge has already said no. It's the first, but probably not the last time we'll see this kind of request made in court. Jonathan Hack is a legal expert on international criminal justice, PhD, with a focus on image-based evidence. Mr. Hack, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So, Jonathan, as Ryan mentioned, at the end of last month, a Washington state judge overseeing a triple murder case barred the use of video enhanced by artificial intelligence as evidence in the trial on the basis that the technology is novel and relies on opaque methods to represent what the AI model thinks should be shown in the video. Can you tell us a little bit more about this case and this particular ruling by the judge?
Sure. This was a case that involved a violent confrontation, and portions of that confrontation were captured on video. What typically happens is a forensic video analyst will analyze video to determine what detail they can get from those images to try and learn as much truth as possible from those images. That's what happened in the Washington case. But then the defense retained the services of their own expert, who instead of doing that forensic process, used an AI tool to hallucinate that video and show a different perception of portions of that event. And so at issue in the Washington case was whether the correct method, forensic video analysis, should be used, or whether the hallucinated enhanced video should be admitted into evidence.
Professor, is this different than, you know, non-AI technology being sharpened up or being, you know, used in these kind of proceedings in the past? That's gone on for years, right? Where you might use a piece of video or enhance the sound, not changing it, but making it easier to digest. How is this different from that?
Yeah. So traditionally, forensic video analysis and audio analysis it takes existing content and clarifies it or enhances it so that we can better see detail, we can better hear audio, just as you've described. What AI does is it looks at what's there and that it hallucinates or decides what it thinks should be there. And the problem there, this is where it goes off the rails, is you've got an algorithm deciding what it thinks should be there, even though when in fact it may not actually be there. And that's the challenge in Washington. And that's the challenge in general, because AI hallucinates what should be there when that may not actually be there.
So, Jonathan, both a company representative of the AI software company, which is Topaz Labs, both a company representative as well as an expert for the prosecution said that this enhanced video should not be used. You've used the wording hallucinating. Can we get a little more granular about what both of those individuals said?
Sure. AI is used for a lot of legitimate purposes. If you've watched Game of Thrones, there's lots of AI in there where we're hallucinating images. It didn't really happen, but they look great because we're using them for entertainment purposes. When we use an AI tool for forensic purposes, for truth-finding purposes, then we're giving up to the computer to decide what it thinks is there when there may be no basis for that. So that's the real challenge. If you think of things like deepfakes, where we put one person's head on another person's head, that's using artificial intelligence to hallucinate what that would look like, but it's not real. Perfectly fine for entertainment purposes, that's fun. But we can't have fun in the courtroom and use evidence that in the end is neither authentic nor reliable.
So, Professor, to that point, when you introduce evidence, you know you have to, as you mentioned, ensure and prove that it is not just relevant, but that there's some foundation to it, right? And we all go through that test when we're introducing evidence, and you have to overcome the presumption that some of this is junk science. You have to overcome, you know, the Daba rule is the one that applies here. So what did the proponent of this evidence do to try to lay the foundation for the introduction of this evidence? And how might future litigants try to do things differently given what happened here?
Sure. Well, frankly, they didn't lay a foundation for tendering this
evidence. That's the problem, right?
And that was the real problem. They used someone who has a production background, someone who had no forensic training, used a tool that was never intended for forensic purposes, and that's what the company itself has said, that it shouldn't be used for forensic purposes. Someone who had no training, no qualifications, no peer review work, no testing, and used a black box or opaque method to hallucinate media. That is the very last thing that we need in the courtroom. Everything that happens in court has to be through what we call a glass box presentation. We should be able to see from beginning to end how you got from point A to point B so that we can have confidence that the version being shown in court is real evidence. And that was the real challenge in this case. They presented evidence that could not be authenticated and therefore wasn't reliable for use by the judge. And so in this Frye hearing in Washington State, the judge correctly said that this is not evidence that has gained general acceptance in the relevant scientific community and has no business in a criminal case.
So, Jonathan, last question here on Legal Face-Off. Is there a place for AI right now in the courtroom? And, you know, even whether there is or there isn't, as this whole landscape continues to evolve, who should be making the decisions about whether this type of technology and what aspects of this type of technology are appropriate for the courtroom?
Sure. I think there may be a place. I work extensively in image-based evidence, both domestically and internationally. And I would never shy away from using advanced technology in the courtroom, provided it's used in a way that we can show it generates authentic and reliable work. So to say as a blanket statement, AI has no role in a courtroom, I think that would be false. I think there is a role if it's used correctly. Your second question, who decides? Two parts. Number one, the lawyers have to decide whether this evidence should ever be put in front of a courtroom. So that's what happened in Washington State. And then ultimately, the judge will decide whether it meets the necessary tests. But the judge can't decide that on his or her own. They need the benefit of competent lawyers making submissions and extra competent experts giving the necessary information to the court.
What's interesting is you kind of would have figured that the prosecutors would be the ones trying to introduce AI in this case rather than the defense team. That's just me. That's just the way I thought. Thank you, Mr. Hack, for joining us. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Well, we are in an election year. And of course, we're talking not only about the presidential race, the Senate and the House, but also about the future of the Supreme Court. And there are some rumors going around that Justice Sonia Sotomayor is ready to retire and may want to get that in before the election so Joe Biden can pick a replacement. But of course, it's an election year, which means that will be an easy process. Paul Campos is a professor of law at University of Colorado. Professor Campos, thanks for joining us here on Legal Faceoff.
Good to be here.
So, Professor, news broke recently that there have been calls for Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who is 69 years old and diabetic, that there have been calls for her to retire so that, as Ryan mentioned, President Biden can pick another justice before the election. Are these reports true, and who is actually pushing for her retirement?
A number of political and legal commentators in the last few weeks, myself included, have been raising this issue and arguing that it would be a good thing for Justice Sotomayor to retire. Recently, Senator Richard Blumenthal said in a very tactful way, but unmistakably, that he thought this is something that Justice Sotomayor should consider. And I think there's just a growing number of people, both in the media and in the political system, who are at least raising the issue in a way that requires, I think, Justice Sotomayor to at least pay some attention to the arguments that are being made that it would be a good thing for her to retire at this point. So I don't see any indication to this point that she herself is at the moment thinking about retiring. But I guess I would say that it would be good if we could get her to take the proposition seriously.
Professor, these calls reflect the reality of what's going on in the last at least 10 years of the Supreme Court, a body that we would like to think is apolitical and, you know, nonpartisan. But in fact, a lot of the appointments have been made surrounding some of these kind of decisions. Right. We know that, you know, outgoing Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell engineered the refusal to take up Obama's nominee, the current Attorney General. So it seems like in recent years, strategies like the one that you're talking about have been essential in the makeup of the court. Should it be that way? I mean, that's not what we'd like, but I think it's a reflection of the reality, yes?
Well, ideally, it should not be that way. But it's also true that given the current system, it's absolutely inevitable that it will be that way. So asking justices to engage in serious consideration of strategic retirement is an absolute necessity under current political conditions. And that's just the world that we live in. I myself would like to see the kind of reforms that would make that kind of strategic retirement unnecessary. But until those reforms actually take place, then I think we have to ask justices to be realistic and to take into account that, in fact, it is a highly political process to appoint people to the Supreme Court. And therefore, justices need to think about their retirement in politically strategic terms.
So, Professor, let's drill down on that a little bit more. You know, as you've alluded to, there has been a lot of airplay about Supreme Court reform, including calls for the elimination of lifetime appointments. Why don't you share some of your thoughts on how you would reform the process if you had the chance to?
I would advocate reforms that would, in fact, eliminate lifetime tenure for Supreme Court justices. Not lifetime tenure as federal judges. They would be able to continue to serve you know, in that capacity. But in terms of lifetime tenure on the Supreme Court itself, I think a very sensible proposal that's been put forth by many people is to have, say, 18-year terms for Supreme Court justices that would then allow each presidential administration to choose two Supreme Court justices to serve on the court. I think that would be an excellent reform. It would make all kinds of sense. It would put way less pressure on individual justices to think in these sorts of strategic terms. And also, I think it would broaden the kind of age range consideration for new Supreme Court justices, which is now being focused on younger and younger people because of these sort of strategic considerations. So I would like to see some legislation along those lines.
Do you think the chances of any of that happening are likely given the current makeup of the legislature and their seeming unwillingness to take up these kind of issues?
I think there are two things in play here. One is, I think it will become evident to people across the political spectrum that some kind of reform along these lines is necessary, and that instead of trying to take strategic advantage of whatever the particular situation is right at the moment, we need some kind of global reform along those lines. So I do think that we will reach a moment when such sort of legislation will be tenable. The other wild card here, though, unfortunately, is that it's up to the Supreme Court itself to decide if such legislation is constitutional. And that obviously leads to a massive conflict of interest and could be a very tricky question. Although one way of dealing with that would be to grandfather such legislation and only apply it to Supreme Court justices in the future.
Professor, last question here. In addition to the strategic decision that you're talking about that might prompt Sotomayor to retire, while Biden can name her replacement, do you think the fact that she's in the minority of a very conservative, perhaps the most conservative Supreme Court ever, and she's talked openly about this recently, she's talked about how frustrating that is and how difficult it is sometimes to go to work. How much of that do you think factors into the equation?
Well, I think it ought to factor quite a bit into the equation that Justice Sotomayor, who I think has done an outstanding job during her tenure, must find it very, very frustrating to be working under the conditions that she's working. And I think it is very reasonable for both she personally and for people who support her and her legal and political orientation to say, look, maybe it's time for somebody else to have to deal with those kinds of frustrations, which are going to remain considerable for, unfortunately, a number of years going forward. So I think, you know, just in sum, I think she's done a great job. I think she's been a great justice. But I think it would be best for the country and for the legal system for her to move on at this point.
Justice Sotomayor was appointed by former President Obama, 69 years old, Tina mentioned. She's the oldest Democrat appointed justice right now in the high court. Thank you very much, Professor Campos.
Well, thanks for having me.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesars Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
It's time for the legal grab bag. Joseph Esses is an associate attorney in the corporate department at Gordon Law Group. Mr. Esses, thank you for jumping on with us this morning.
Thanks for having me. I think this is my third time. Third time's the charm, I hope.
We're also joined by Joey Christopoulos, a producer of Beyond the Big Ten. Thanks for joining us, Joey.
Thank you so much for having me, Rich. Tina, it's great to be back on the show. It's like putting on an old coat. Let's do it. I'm excited.
Well, let's start with Trump Watch 2024. A couple things to point out in recent days. Legal analysts say the former president's $175 million bond in his New York civil fraud case is about to implode. Another legal analyst says Trump may be falling into the same trap in his upcoming hush money case. Rich, you're on the Trump beat this week.
Unbelievably, we are actually looking at a week away from a Trump criminal trial. Let's take a moment and just sink that in for a second. The former president, the perhaps future president, again, we know he is leading polls, is going to go on trial finally in New York in the hush money case, a real life criminal trial. So jury selection begins on April 15th. He made some efforts, Tina, predictably, as he has throughout the course of this case, to overturn the judge's gag order. He's been attacking Judge Merchan and Judge Merchan's daughter. He's been attacking Alvin Bragg, of course, the Manhattan district attorney. He tried on Monday to delay the trial until after the election, when that was denied. So, you know, if you thought this was a fun feature of our show in the past, wait till we see Trump facing this criminal trial. So it should be exciting. And again, by all accounts, I mean, this is a pretty clear violation of campaign finance laws. Again, the allegation is that he paid Stormy Daniels $130,000 during the 2016 presidential election to hide an extramarital affair. He will, of course, attack Stormy Daniels, who is expected to testify. But I know I'm excited, Tina.
Yeah, I'm very excited. I think one of the main questions at this point is, you know, is he going to testify? I mean, I think by all accounts, folks are saying it's in his best interest not to. But we sort of know how these things go, and he may insist on testifying. So it's going to be interesting to see, Rich, the next time we do our next show, you know, we may very well be reporting from courtside, right?
Yeah. I mean, Joey, we've never seen this happen before. Of course, we've never seen a former president indicted, let alone possibly convicted of a crime. We'll see how that impacts the campaign. Of course, Trump has tried everything he can to delay all of this, as we talked about, until after the campaign, so that he could, you know, perhaps pardon himself, disband any of the federal cases that are going. This one is a New York State case. At least, again, this seems like all there might be some last minute, you know, changes. We know that Trump has had remarkable luck legally so far. But this one seems like it's a go next week.
Yeah, and when the article was sent over to me, the headline said Trump risks making same mistake again, which gave me a great laugh. So the topic started off as a comedy, but then I started thinking about the election and then it turned more into a horror thriller. 34 felony counts. And to be honest, you know, I'm a little bit of an outsider. I'm the sports media side of things, but I do find it incredibly interesting that the case, one of the things that the defense is worried about is him demanding to go and testify for himself. I mean, I don't want to throw it back to you guys, or maybe we'll throw it to Joseph, but what do you say to your client when they are mandating that they testify when everyone on the planet knows that that's a bad idea?
Yeah, it's just a crazy concept, right? Imagine being the attorney that is questioning Donald Trump and like while he's testifying. I just couldn't even imagine it. He's a former president, like Rich said, he might be the next president as well. It's difficult to tell them like, hey, like we don't want you to testify. It's not great for the strategy. It's not great for the game plan. It's a difficult decision that his attorneys are going to have. But yeah, it's
just and to that point, we just talked about in the Crumbly case to start off the show a little bit a few minutes ago that in that case, Jennifer Crumbly, the mom of the Michigan shooter, testified, and her mistake was saying that she would not do things differently. The jury really tied into that, and that's why many of them said they found the way she did. So, you know, there's good and bad, but we all know there's no way that Trump would not testify. And let's also look at the bigger picture. The bigger picture with all of this, as we know, is that Trump is not testifying for the people in the jury. He's testifying for the millions and millions of people outside who are following him. Mm-hmm. And in the short term, while he may lose the criminal trial, which is a big deal, he might go, you know, actually to prison. It will and has helped him in the general election. So crazy stuff, but really interesting.
All right. Well, an Oregon-based group is suing actress Gwyneth Paltrow for trademark infringement over its Good Clean Goop women's health products. They say that's similar to their name, Good Clean Love, and that's creating some confusion. Tina, what's going on with this story?
So, Ryan, last week, the company Good Clean Love sued Gwyneth Paltrow's company Goop for trademark infringement, false advertising, and unfair competition, claiming that Goop's use of their brand Good Clean Goop in connection with women's health products is likely to cause confusion with Good Clean Love, and also claims that Gwyneth Paltrow's brand has been threatening its reputation, and that it may cause something which we trademark lawyers call reverse confusion, and they're seeking injunctive and monetary relief. In a typical trademark infringement case, allegations are that the defendant, who is usually the more recent user of the trademark that's in dispute, is likely to cause confusion with the more senior trademark owner. But in a reverse confusion case, which we see less frequently, that is flipped. So the allegations are that the public is going to believe that the senior user is the junior user, because the junior user here, Gwyneth Paltrow's company, has caused market saturation. Good Clean Love, the plaintiff here, is a 20-year-old company that has a niche in selling women's health and hygiene products. And they claim that Goop originally offered cosmetics, dietary, and nutritional supplements in connection with its mark, which are a bit different from what Good Clean Love is doing. But now they're alleging that Goop is using its brand to push products that are a lot closer to Good Clean Love's products than what they have historically been offering. There are also allegations here that, you know, usually we think that celebrities will always bring a positive sort of spin to a product, but Good Clean Love here claims that that's not the case, because Paltrow, they allege, sells treatments that are not based on hardcore science, which Good Clean Love claims that they do. And that there's also indications of confusion in the market, particularly when looking at people's social media posts. So not surprisingly, a Goop spokesperson has said that the complaint is meritless and has pointed to a market which they claim is saturated with third-party uses of the phrase Good Clean. And they're hoping and seem pretty confident that they are going to be able to distinguish Gwyneth Paltrow's products from those of the plaintiff. So I always love these types of cases, Rich. They're interesting. And we don't really see reverse confusion cases all that frequently, where the junior user ends up oversaturating the market to the point where the senior user thinks that there's going to be confusion running the other way.
Yeah, I mean, you don't see them too often, obviously, where the junior user has the celebrity status of Gwyneth Paltrow and has the, you know, brand awareness that she's developed over this, over the years of this product. But also, thank God for Gwyneth, guys, because she is like, well, she is a rising star in legal content for us, because we can't forget the months we spent on her incredibly fascinating trial where she was involved with the skier. And also the other case we have covered in the past on Legal Face-Off, going back a few years, was where an individual who bought one of her candles that was, and I'm just going to tell you that the name of the candle was a vagina scented candle. He alleged that exploded and burned him. So good for Gwyneth. Keep getting involved in these kind of lawsuits, because it provides us lots of content. But Joe, yeah, I mean, it seems like there's, like, you know, if you go down the supermarket aisle and you go to a cleaning section or go to a candle section, you know, you're going to see many, many products using the terms good, clean, healthy. Those are more than ever terms that are out there on the market. Do you think any one of these litigants can claim a monopoly or, you know, the rights to use those terms?
Yeah, it just seems like a generic use of those terms, especially in, like, cleaning and, like, health categories, to have, like, good, clean. The Good Clean Love, that adds another layer to it, I guess. But yeah, you're right. Like, Gwyneth Paltrow, no stranger to the courtroom. That ski crash case is really interesting. I think they're making, like, a West End musical called Gwyneth Goes Skiing that's going to debut in December. So that's interesting case. Hopefully they don't have to make another play on this one. But yeah, instances of reverse confusion are few and far between. Like the regular standard likelihood of confusion is much more common. I think like the Goodyear test is like for the reverse confusion. So it's an interesting case. I don't know too much about women's health products, but I'll be following along.
Well, I will say that when the inevitable lawsuit comes because someone copied the vagina scented candle, that I think has some merit because, you know, there aren't that many candles, I think, that are called the smells like vagina, which again, I'm not making this stuff up. That's the actual title of the product. So that's maybe where she has more of a lawsuit. But Joey, what's your take on this? Or is this just, you know, big companies arguing with each other? I mean, there is some to be said for brand protection. You're in the sports media business. You know how important these brands are.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think it's funny that Goop's case is definitely the old early 90s. No, you got to understand, it's din 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 din. But I do din 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 din. See, I changed it. I changed it just a little bit there. Yeah, I think in the growing world, especially in sports media, when you talk about SEO and you're trying to talk about optimizing key phrases, keywords, and easy ways for people to access whatever content that is you want to put out, it does kind of muddy the waters a little bit when we're talking about words like good, clean, love. The thing that I think differentiates this, obviously, is obviously now they're trying to move into the same product pool that this company's been around for 20 years. So I want to push back a little bit on, there are a lot of generic terms that we put out there, especially in the marketplace. But at the same time, I like that this case is going to trial, hopefully, because I still feel like my instinct says that this is a bigger company just trying to take down somebody a little bit smaller. And we see it happen all the time. And it's something that we have to ward off as we move forward. So I think creating a history or a precedent of cases like this, whether this one wins or not, I still think is an important thing moving forward, because this just seems way too easy to do. When you're trying to distill words to the most common basic phrases possible to try and sell product.
Well, this is what I spend my life doing is as a trademark lawyer. And that's where like the nuance and the sophistication, the complexities are, because there are so many companies that have brands that are generic or dictionary words, but in the context of how they use them, they're either not generic out of the gate, or even if they're descriptive, they can become what we call have acquired secondary meaning. And so, I agree with you. That's going to be a crux of the case, is when you look at how people use the words good and clean juxtaposed, there's a lot of that use, but there's a niche here that I think is really the crux of the plaintiff's case here. So it'll be interesting to watch this one.
The firm Simpson, Thatcher, and Bartlett celebrated World Sleep Day by giving out sleep-related swag. Though the company is infamously known for working these corporate teams deep into the night. Rich, this didn't go over so great.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think the intent of the firm might have been good in promoting good sleep habits. They gave out sleep masks. They gave out a book on why we sleep, which talks about the importance of sleep to your health. But you know what they, I guess, didn't realize is how it would be interpreted, because as Ryan mentioned, they are working their people very hard, and it's not uncommon at this firm to be working, you know, well into 2 or 3 a.m. So I think one takeaway here is as good as the intent might be conscious of how that looks. I think every associate who's working hard is going to look skeptically at these kind of things. And the other lesson is, as reported by our friend Catherine Rubino at Above the Law, like this stuff is always gets leaked. Above the Law is incredible at finding every memo that's distributed by every firm. And this one wasn't interpreted so well.
Yeah, Rich. No, I think that there isn't anything wrong with providing the swag, you know, along these lines, but it's all the context, right? So if you're a firm that does not really have a culture around self-care and that sort of thing, then it is going to fall on deaf ears, and you are going to have people engaging in various things like eye rolling when they get this kind of swag, because it's a stark sort of juxtaposition to what the culture is at the firm, which is to be having people working late, working hard, billing a lot of hours. So, but there are firms out there. I mean, mine is one where, there is messaging from the top, from the chairman himself about the importance of self-care. And so I think in that context, those sorts of gifts would probably be viewed a little bit differently.
Joe, you work at a firm. You've worked at a couple different places. How do you think this kind of things, as a new, relatively new attorney, you've been practicing for a few years, how do you think this kind of thing goes over?
Yeah, I'm very thankful that my firm's a little more thoughtful with their gifts to the associates. But yeah, definitely a very, very tough gift to provide some very tired associates. Like you said, Rich, some of these attorneys are working till 2, 3 a.m. And just giving them a book on how important sleep is just a slap in the face. So it's I have friends at big law firms that receive like iPads and AirPods as gifts. So I'd be a little taken aback by getting like an eye mask to wear while I'm sleeping, when I'm staying up till 3 a.m. to work.
So Joe, the message to your employer is you're not shy about receiving the newest AirPods or
I won't iPad. Be mad about it. No.
You won't link that to above the law.
Well, speaking of sleep or lack thereof, Madonna's defense for her late concerts is that it's not her responsibility if fans have to wake up early following those late shows, Rich?
Yeah, I mean, newsflash, guys. Artists don't show up at a concert at the time that is printed on the ticket, or these days on your digital ticket. I mean, you know, we've reported on this lawsuit before. This was some guys who went to the Madonna concert, Tina, and they were unhappy because she showed up late, and they sued, alleging a variety of damages. These guys went to the concert at Barclays Center, and they said that her tardiness was a wanton exercise in false advertising, negligent misrepresentation, and unfair and deceptive trade practices. They went on to say, Tina, that Madonna and her other co-defendants failed to give proper notice of this, blah, blah, blah. And the judge has basically said, newsflash, she's Madonna, right? you know, they're called divas for a reason, number one. Number two, like, have you never been to a concert? Thankfully, there's some common sense left in these proceedings, and they're like, the judge basically said, yeah, have you never been to a concert? Everyone knows that they don't come on at the start. Sometimes there are opening acts, as we all know, and that it's an evening. So besides all that, even if they establish liability, right, the liability portion is whether Madonna engaged in these deceptive practices. The second question, as we've now talked about in many cases in legal grab bag over almost 10 years, is what are the damages? You know, I mean, even if these plaintiffs can prove that they were damaged somehow and that she is liable, what are the damages, really? So you had to wait. Does that cause emotional stress? Does that cause, you know, some kind of long-term PTSD? Stop it. So in this case, the case was properly dismissed, and Madonna gets to, you know, continue her late ways.
Yeah, Rich, I mean, for those of us who have been going to concerts for decades, I mean, this is no different than what like other artists historically did, like, you know, I don't know, Guns N' Roses, Prince, you name it. There's like a long list of artists that would like show up in the middle of the night for, you know, a time show time of like 8 or 8:30. So, and I agree with your assessment on this. We've been covering this story since the lawsuit was initially filed. I think we just have, as we often do, a bunch of litigious folks who are looking to try to make a buck, hoping that this would somehow settle rather than, you know, be litigated. And so I think it's the right result. It's crazy stuff.
Tina, you completely nailed this on the head. Growing up, when a band would go late into the night, that used to be called a gift. It used to be called a treasure. How was the concert last night? Man, they played till 12:15 last night. 12:15? Yeah, even during the concert, they said, hey, do you want to hear some more? And we all said yes. I'm sorry, but Judge Joey is calling this like one of the softest things I've heard all month, maybe of 2024. It's absolutely ridiculous. They had to not only irritate our court system, but I guarantee you they irritated people behind them. There are definitely the people at 8:50 when she's not on the stage going, oh, I got to work tomorrow. Like talking about work at a concert when it's supposed to be an escape. And then the best part about it was that they had the gall to try and file suit after there's no evidence that they left the concert early. They stayed for the whole thing. They were just, their whole case is that they were put out, that they had to get home late one night. I'm calling this soft. Judge Joey, softest thing I've heard all year.
Decision made.
Throw this out.
Karen. What do you call male Karens again? What's the name of the male Karen? I forget.
Oh, Cody's? No, wait, like it's a C word, right?
Yeah, there is a term for these guys are the male Karens.
Yeah. Well, by the way, along, a retread of a movie brought a retread of a lawsuit filed back in the 80s. But Tina, it looks like a judge has grounded the newest lawsuit against the Top Gun series.
Yeah, Ryan. So last Friday, the copyright infringement case that had been filed back in 2022 against Paramount Studios involving the movie Top Gun Maverick in the Central District of California was dismissed. So the lawsuit had been filed by the family of Ehud Yonah, whose 1983 magazine article had inspired the original Top Gun film, which many of us remember from our, you know, childhood, that came out back in 1986. After the sequel, Top Gun Maverick, was released back in 2022, Yonah's family sued Paramount, claiming that the film was a derivative work under copyright law of his article, and that Paramount had failed to renegotiate a new license before creating the sequel film, and that its rights to the article ended in 2020, but that the filming of the movie did not end until May of 2021. Paramount disagreed, stating that the film was sufficiently completed before their rights to use the article were terminated, and they also disagreed that the film constituted a derivative work. The judge sided with Paramount on summary judgment, stating that the Maverick movie and the article are largely dissimilar, including the plot, theme, setting, and dialogue, and did not overlap meaningfully with Ehud's article. The attorneys for the plaintiff have already said that they will appeal the decision to the Ninth Circuit. So, Rich, I think that this is the right result. Not sure where you come out on this one.
I come out on the side of Maverick and Goose always. that's my take on this case. But yeah, I mean, listen, anytime, Joey, there's a successful film, a successful song, a successful book, there's always trollers who come out and, you know, allege that they've been ripped off and want a little piece of the pie. Top Gun Maverick, one of the most successful films of all time. They're coming out with part three soon, not soon enough for this guy. Yeah, I think it's the right decision. And there's enough Maverick to go around for all of us. Joey, I know you, what we all didn't give Joey enough credit for, we'll get to Joey in a second on this too, is not only is he a maven of all things sports, but he's got a love of 80s action films that rivals anyone's. And we haven't even talked about Roadhouse. We'll talk about Roadhouse maybe at the end, but the remake of Roadhouse, because I know that's right up Joey's alley. But Joey, what's your take on this story?
I'm doing my Conor McGregor from Roadhouse right now.
Yeah. who knew that Conor McGregor was just a head on massive shoulder pads? I found the same thing unnerving.
Yeah, so my only thing that I found interesting about the article, and unfortunately I didn't dig deeper, so if there is a terminology there, please let me know. But typically, from what I understand out here in the entertainment business, is do they have rights to the characters? Have they trademarked the names of the characters? And if they haven't, I think they're a little SOL on this situation. Rich, you did a great job of mentioning music. You know what I mean? We play the same four chords in different variations, different arrangements. We've been telling the same stories for centuries, and a story about a guy trying to get redemption at his old job and also trying to look after and protect a younger person, whether it is his son or whether it's something else. I mean, it's an amalgamation of a bunch of different stories. So unless this particular case, they have trademark over the characters, which you see a lot now in films in the opening credits, go all the way back to whatever, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, James Bond, whatever that is, they still get credit for that. If they don't have credit over the trademark of the characters, I don't think they have a leg to stand on in this one at all.
Well, I mean, trademark and characters is really a merchandising thing. I mean, again, this is sort of where there are big distinctions in IP between trademarking and copywriting things. But like, as a general matter, you can't trademark the name of a movie unless it's part of a series. You can't trademark a series of books unless they're part of a series. And really, you can only trademark something when you're actually selling a product or service in connection with that. And that's like a merchandising thing. So I don't know offhand who owns merchandising rights relating to Top Gun. But you know, this has really been much more of a, like, falling within the copyright domain in terms of, and I think a lot of it depends on the agreement that was between the parties going back 40 years.
Yeah. And Joe, I'd be curious to know, because one of the things the judge said in this case was that the elements of Maverick, including the plot, the theme, the setting, the dialogue, were so different from the 1983 article, the plaintiff, that they didn't overlap enough. But be interesting if this case does get reversed on appeal, and they said they're going to appeal it to the Ninth Circuit. If there is some discovery, I'd be curious to see how much the filmmakers intentionally made these plot changes because they were conscious of this, you know, potential. So if I was a filmmaker, I would certainly put as many, you know, differentiators in the plot as I can to avoid this kind of liability, because let's face it, it made so much money that there is some huge exposure. So I bet that played into the screenplay and how the movie was made.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So originally Paramount got the license from the article writer's family back in like 1983. And then the license was expiring like in 2021, I think. And I don't know if you guys remember this, but there was like a video going around social media with Tom Cruise just being absolutely livid with the staff for all of the delays related to COVID and like making sure everyone was wearing their masks and because he wanted to get the film out. So I'm not sure if the changes were enough. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what the Ninth Circuit says about it, but I think it's an interesting case for sure.
So Morgan Wallen is back in the news for chucking a chair at a Nashville bar. Maybe not the worst thing in the world, but just another in a series of incidents involving this country music dude. Tina, do we love this guy? Do we hate this guy? What's going on with him?
Well, I didn't really have much of an opinion of this guy, but I have to say after studying up on this story, I'm not so sure that he's in my, you know, bucket of favorite people in the world. So Ryan, as you said, over the weekend, country music star Morgan Wallen was arrested and charged with 3 counts of reckless endangerment and 1 count of disorderly conduct after throwing a chair off a rooftop bar in Nashville, which happened to land on the street below near 2 police officers. And as you said, this is not the first time he's had a run-in with the law. There's quite a list of issues that he's had over the last several years, including being kicked out of Kid Rock's bar in 2020 and being arrested, being caught partying without a mask in the middle of lockdown in 2020, dropping out of various appearances on TV and in concert, unfortunately using the N-word during performances, and the list goes on. It's interesting that some of the media outlets have been gauging fan reactions rather than just reporting the story. They've actually been reporting on how fans have reacted to this. And not surprisingly, the reactions are all over the map, some saying that this will likely make him more popular, while others speculate that he might be canceled. He was booked for the arrest later in the evening on Sunday and had a wide smile in his mugshot, and was later released on a $15,000 bond. The arrest report said that the police viewed video showing him lunging and throwing the chair over the roof. His first court appearance has been set for the morning of May 3rd, and he's got a scheduled concert later that day at Nissan Stadium in Nashville. So, Rich, as we like to cover on the show, more celebrities behaving badly.
Yeah, I mean, it carries a potential six-year prison term. We know he's not going to see that. But, you know, there's some good news and bad news for Wall. I mean, he's had run-ins before. He infamously used a racial term that got him kicked off SNL. But again, we're in the Trump era where doing things bad that used to get you canceled, used to get you disqualified from performing ever again, seemingly gains you more support. I saw a bunch of interviews with his fans this morning, and you know, most of them are still supporting him. You know, listen, he is a rock star. He's hugely popular. Throwing furniture off the roofs of places is not unprecedented in the world of rock stars. But yeah, not great behavior, not a great, you know, role model, and there seems to be continued substance abuse presumably involved. But it's Nashville. I've been to Nashville, but I've seen crazier things thrown off high areas in Nashville. Joey, what's your take? Are you convicting or canceling Wallen or no?
Well, I mean, look, I love a good Motley Crue story like anybody else, right? And I think we all grew up with these tall tales of the other things that they wrecked and destroyed in different kinds of hotel rooms. You know, I don't really listen to Morgan Wallen's music, so this has always been from afar. Just kind of like seems like guy does dumb things, says dumb stuff, does new dumb thing, will continue to do dumb things moving forward. So I would want to caution the gentleman there to not pull a Nikki Sixx at some point in his life, if you know what I'm talking about, Rich. And maybe, you know, you can't push it a little bit too far. The thing that I found interesting about this case is that this obviously seems to be chum in the water for the outraged society. When we talk about outgroup think and we talk about negative bias and how negative stories create virality and create conversation on the internet, this just seems ready, packaged, perfectly made for the type of discourse that people like to have on the internet these days. So, Tina, you brought up a great point that I think a lot of people are going to use the word outrage and use the word cancel. But again, when we talk about that outgroup disposition and that kind of discourse, I think from a PR perspective, it is probably good for him, right? Because now he gets to have the follow-up interview where he's like, I've learned from my ways, or whatever that is, or do the concert where he says, I haven't learned from my ways. And this just seems to be kind of the cesspool that we live in a little bit when it comes to social media.
Yeah, I mean, Joey raises a great point. And as a veteran of the media, he knows the importance of, like, you know, earning free media. I mean, imagine how much free media this guy has earned. And, you know, it's not, I mean, he didn't kill anyone. He didn't hit the police officers with a chair. So in the grand scheme of things, if you really take a deep dive and look into the value of the attention he's received, probably a huge net positive for his brand, right, in that respect.
Yeah. Yeah, he's definitely no stranger to the Nashville jail and the booking officers at the police department. This is not his first run-in with the law, as you guys mentioned, but he is on top of the world. Like, Nashville is a country music town. Like, he is one of, if not the biggest country music star today. Just imagine walking or stumbling down Broadway in Nashville and just seeing a chair fall from down the sky and going on Twitter the next day and seeing that it was Morgan Wallen who threw it. That would just be a huge.
Where's that chair? The question is, who's got that chair? That chair is worth
rock and roll
million
fame.
Bucks right now. Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Hang it up in the rafters.
The mullet Hall of Fame.
Well, the eclipse was a generational experience. So should inmates have been denied the opportunity? Six inmates in New York sued to throw on those paper glasses and stare at the sun. Tina's on the solar block. Tina.
Yeah, Ryan. So hopefully whatever sunglasses or glasses they put on were not one of the brands that had been recalled right before the eclipse. So six incarcerated men sued New York State for the chance to view Monday's solar eclipse. They're incarcerated at the Woodbourne Correctional Facility in Sullivan County. They filed the lawsuit a number of weeks ago. And the way it turns out is that, yes, these six men were allowed to watch the solar eclipse. And the person who was leading the charge, Jeremy Zielinski, who is an atheist and who, according to state prison records, is serving a 14 and a half year sentence for first degree rape, said that the experience was sublime. And that the victory here was that the state recognized that when you look at the group of men who were plaintiffs in the lawsuit, that there was a recognition that religious beliefs, which was really the pivotal point here, that they don't have to be faith specific and are protected even when they're based in different faiths. So they had argued in their lawsuit that the corrections department's decision to lock down its prisons statewide on Monday illegally prohibited them from observing the eclipse. And last week, the Department of Corrections agreed to let them observe it. And in any event, I don't know, I have mixed feelings about this one, Rich. You know, if it's truly a religious belief, I can understand why the decision came down the way it did, but I can also see the potential for abuse of that argument.
You think? Yeah. Make sure more. Let's make sure more rapists use the court system to make sure they get out of their prison cells to look up at the sun for hours, because God forbid they get deprived of that right. I mean, come on, what total nonsense. I mean, what they should have done is be forced to look at the eclipse with no glasses. That would have been, I could have signed off on that. You know, if you're a convicted rapist, you have to look at the eclipse with no glasses. I'm all in for that. Sign me up for that lawsuit. I will write an amicus brief for that. But man, tying up the legal system, alleging that you're religious. I want to see this person's, you know, 364 day regimen otherwise. I want to see all the times he's devoted himself to religion aside from this. So yeah, bunch of junk. But I watched the eclipse for about a second and it was fine. Enough of the eclipse. Let's move the hell on as a society. Can we just move on, Joe Essus?
No, yeah, absolutely. I spent probably 2 minutes out there. Like, it was like, really, this is it? Like, this is what all the hype was about? I didn't get it at all. And like, this lawsuit is just absolutely ridiculous. As you're saying, like, these convicted, like, rapists, like these murderers, like kidnappers, like trying to say they have a legal right to view the eclipse. It's just nuts. I agree with your sentiment that they should have to Donald Trump it and look at it like he did in the last eclipse without any glasses. So. Yeah, it's interesting.
Joey, they're sending rapists. They're sending their bad hombres. They want to see this.
Field trip, whole jail. Let's bring the whole jail, guys, next time. Let's just do the whole thing. We're going to get together. And no, look, one of the quotes was especially cringy for this particular gentleman to say this. It is a celebration of our shared humanity and everyone is welcome moment. I don't really know what else to say on that one. It is an interesting point that an atheist can claim a religious belief. I'm slightly on board on that as some sort of grounds to at least make a case. But let's just get to the eclipse real quick. Are we all saying this is like a Roger Ebert thumbs up, thumbs down? This is like a two-star? This was a two-star eclipse?
It's like cool.
I mean, I thought it was cool, but you have to realize that like there's a big difference between seeing it here in Chicago and seeing it downstate or in Indianapolis or in Ohio.
Nothing happened here in LA. Like there was nothing. Nothing.
No path of destruction. Action. Well, let's end off the show with learning a little bit more about everyone. Get back to our friends, Tom Cruise. Let's go around the horn. Ryan Burrow, we'll start with you. Favorites. I don't think we've done this one before, Tina. Maybe we have. Favorite Tom Cruise movie of all time. Have we done this one? No?
I don't think so.
Gosh. Wow, Ryan Burrow, I'm prepared.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not a Cruise guy.
All right, think about it.
Yeah, we'll go there.
Oh, you're talking about Jerry Maguire. Okay.
Dang, we're gonna leave.
You can't duplicate it, Joe. Go. Yeah, what else you got?
Gotta think about it now.
Wow.
I'll say Top Gun. I wanted to be a naval aviator after seeing that movie. And I'm a big Anthony Edwards fan. And obviously he was Goose. I mean, there was just so much great stuff about that movie, including the soundtrack. So, I mean, to me, and I was also a teenage girl who thought Tom Cruise was really cute. So.
Wow. Weirdly enough, after seeing it, I want to have sex with a naval aviator after seeing Top Gun. So it's kind of strange how that worked out. Joey, I learned
volleyball.
Exactly.
I got to learn how to play volleyball.
I mean, shirtless volleyball in the jeans. I mean, that's an interesting choice.
This is crazy. I'm surrounded by
I can't believe it.
Talented litigators, and I'm going to Few Good Men, guys. This is it's a Few Good Men.
Great pick.
Top to bottom. You got the lines. You got the crazy Cruise moments. You got him pretending to be drunk. You got him going up against Jack Nicholson. I just love the pace of that movie. I just want to think that all of you at the end of the night just get a box of pens, colored and black, with a bunch of Yoo-Hoo and Cocoa Puffs, and bring whatever else you want because we're going to crack this case. It's a Few Good Men for me all day.
I ate breakfast 200 yards from 4,000 Cubans that are trained to kill me. Don't think you could come down here, flash a badge, and make me nervous. That's a great one. I thought for sure, Joey, you would go with a film that is near and dear to your heart, my heart. We've talked about it before. Coughlin's Rules. We know Coughlin's Rules by heart. The Immortal Cocktail. One of the greatest Cruise films of all time. And one of the brightest teeth Tom Cruise films of all time. Nonstop Smiles, great film. There's so many. Joe Esses, we haven't let you off the hook. We got to go back to you.
I know. Those were probably my top two, Jerry Maguire and A Few Good Men. So I got to throw it way back here. A book I read in probably like the fifth grade. I'm going to go with The Outsiders.
Wow. Esses.
It's a good one.
Crazy Tooth Cruise. That's Crooked Teeth Cruise. Nice. Yeah.
Can I give an honorable mention to Minority Report too?
Oh, that's another based on another book. One of my favorite early Cruise. I'll talk about early Cruise is that you can't go wrong with All the Right Moves. Story of the Ampipe Bulldogs star defensive back Stefan Djordjevic, which was also famous. Speaking, we're very excited. This is a very sexual show. We're talking about vagina. We talked about some other stuff, but that was famous for if you paused All the Right Moves in the right spot, according to not me, but a lot of girls. You could see a little bit of early Tom Cruise. Let's just call it his Maverick at the time. That's what All the Right Moves is famous for. So Check Mr.
Skin. No one said risky business. I can't believe no one said risky business.
Risky Business is a classic Chicago film.
Come on, please. I'm disappointed. Lisa,
Leslie, Lisa, are you there? Any of your favorite Tom Cruise ones before we sign off and go watch all of these?
I like Rock of Ages.
Ooh. Oh, wow.
You're the no one, by the way, you're one of like dozens of people in history who have said those six words. But that's okay. That's a good one.
I'm a Far and Away fan. So, you know what? We all love who we love. You know what I mean? You're a corker, Shannon. You're a corker. And he's just pounding people. I mean, I don't know. It's a dumb Ron Howard movie, but it's good.
That's an awesome. No one said Vanilla Sky, thankfully.
Yeah, more Tom Cruise talk on the Scientology podcast, which will follow shortly after this. Thank you so much, Joey Christopoulos and Joe Esses. And that'll do it for the latest installment of Legal Face-Off on WGN. Special thanks to Professor Jeffrey Swartz of Cooley Law, legal expert Jonathan Heck, Professor Paul Campos from University of Colorado. Also, shouts out to Ben Anderson and Lisa Stegel. For Tina Martini, Rich Lenkoff, I'm Ryan Breaux. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget...